Welcome back to Media Voices, everybody. We are the media-focused podcast that brings you all the news and the views from around the media world. And this episode, we're going to be taking a look back at everything that has happened over summer, specifically six things that you might have missed. And, okay, here's my new position on this. We were the only thing holding back a lot of these stories and a lot of these nightmares. So people should really support us more if they want less of this kind of media bullshit.
Well, maybe people were holding off announcing stuff until we got back.
Yeah.
If you do want to happen over the summer and you're behind, then you should be subscribing to our daily newsletter because we tell you every day what's going on. But the best bit is it's literally just the top four things that have happened that day, even if a million things have happened. So, yeah, if you want to sign up for that, you can go to voices.media and you can pop your email in the pop-up or the sidebar, or we post each issue to Twitter at 7 a.m.
You can also read back through the 100 previous emails that we've done.
Yeah, in the same way that the episodes on the site are an archive, they're like a time capsule now of the last couple of years of media wonk.
If you read back through all 100, though, I'm going to be impressed.
Yeah, how freaking sad would you need to be to read the 100 daily newsletter?
Well, I've gone back through August, so I don't feel really sad.
You say that, but one day a media historian is going to try to chart the rise and rise of Media Voices, which gradually took over the world in much the same way that Facebook has.
Oh, goosebumps.
And they're going to have to go through this.
Goosebumps.
Anyway, in fact, that's a nice little segue into this first story. So, Esther, you said the platforms are your beat. What has happened between Google and Facebook and Australia?
Okay, so it basically seems like all the publishers went on holiday, nobody announced or launched anything, and instead the platforms decided just to have like an absolute litigation party.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's a good way of putting it.
I've split my top two choices into two of the main ones, and this doesn't even cover half of what I want to talk about. So the first one is, I've just called it Google and Facebook versus Australia.
My money's on Australia.
It's very much like Alien versus Predator thing, isn't it? Like
it is. And I'm not going to get through all of this, so I would just say that there are two really good explainers that were linked in the show notes. Axios has done like a really good bullet point style summary, and Digiday has done a much more in-depth explainer of what Google's doing with this.
I think let's begin by giving a little bit of a short pressy of what led to it, because the core of the argument effectively is Australian publishers alleging that there is a huge power imbalance between them and the platforms.
Yeah, so earlier this year, the Australian government asked the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, can you basically draft a code of conduct to sort out this bargaining power imbalance? So the ACCC released this.
I think we should call it A squared C squared.
Probably easier. So in a nutshell, the code will allow news publishers to band together or negotiate individually, and they can go to Google and Facebook and demand compensation when they feature their news articles and their services. And the crux of this basically says that if those parties don't come to an agreement within 3 months, it goes to compulsory arbitration, which would basically end up with the Australian Communications and Media Authority assigning arbitrators, which isn't going to end well for Google and Facebook. I mean, there are a couple of other sticky points that Google's objected to, including there's a requirement to give news publishers 28-day advance warning of algorithm changes, which would give them an unfair advantage. And also there's a bit about the tech companies having to give the data they collect on users when users interact with news content, which, again, for a whole load of data showing reasons, like that's a valid concern.
This code isn't just for Google though, right?
It's for Google. It's basically for Google and Facebook. It would apply to others, but this is targeted specifically at them and the whole.
Well, I'm just thinking on the data part of that. How does that impact Apple?
Let's not even go there. But anyway, we'll go into that a whole load, but I do want to stick with the compensation thing because that's what impacts publishers. So Google and Facebook have said, well, that means that if we go to arbitration, news publishers can essentially demand ludicrous amounts of compensation that would be completely unreasonable as to what they actually generate in Australia.
Yeah.
They've also said the arbitration is going to be unfair because that's the Australian government arbitrating it. And again,
who else is going to do it?
I know, right? So Facebook stayed quiet for the entirety of August, and then at the 1st of September, they went absolutely nuclear.
Yeah.
But they said that they would basically ban Australian users from sharing local or international news content on Facebook.
I think we might end up in a better world if Facebook stopped people sharing shit. I'm not sure this is a bad thing.
Yeah, well, call their bluff.
Because they'll share all the crazy blog posts instead.
It's not sharing. It's not information that's being stopped. It's some legit publishers.
Yeah. Okay, so you just need to stop
Facebook's argument so that I'm not talking all the time.
Well, does this not go back to everything that we've spoken about before about kind of who actually derives value from the publisher platform relationship here?
Yes.
Because, you know, we've said a couple of times that as much as publishers like to argue that they deliver value to Facebook and Google by having their content on the site, in reality, it's a two-way street.
Also, though, you know, we can talk about this again and again and again and again, but we come back to this is like shutting the stable door after the horse has been boiled down for glue.
What is the most likely outcome of this?
Publishers will lose more than Facebook and Google.
So Facebook also dropped like aggressive lot of blog posts, and then
I saw that. That was great.
They pointed out once again, for about the millionth time, that news represents a tiny fraction of what people see in their news feeds. I think it was 4% at the last count.
Yeah.
It's not a significant source of revenue for them. It's the same for Google. And they said, actually, over the first 5 months of 2020, Facebook sent 2.3 billion clicks from Facebook's news feed back to Australian news websites at no charge. And they said that traffic was worth about an estimated $200 million to Australian publishers. And again, we're looking at this. If Facebook decided to switch that off, there's only one group of people that loses out with this.
And, you know, that's the point. You know, so don't switch it off. Just charge the publishers a tiny percentage of a penny for everyone that gets sent to their websites. And then they'll be totally f***ed up anyway. So Google and Facebook cannot lose this fight.
I will say, like, Facebook and Google over the last couple of months have been shouting very, very loudly about their various news tabs. Facebook have just rolled out their news tab in India, and that's the one that does actually license content from a completely random selection of publishers to feature in it. And they've actually accelerated their rollout, but not in Australia, because they've said, well, if Australia are going to play this game, we're not rolling it out. And Google also, again, in Australia, in mid-August said, just to remind you guys, we are actually working on a licensing paid news product for publishers that compensates them fairly for appearing in a dedicated news product, not like a snippet tax or search, which is bonkers.
We're talking about Australia here, but every other country, every other government in the world is watching this and trying to figure out what can we learn from this? Australia just happens to be at the sharp end right now.
I mean, there's the News Media Alliance in the US, if they're pushing for a bill to go ahead, which would, again, allow newspaper companies to collectively negotiate with platforms. Whether they'll do the arbitration or not, I don't know. And then we've obviously had, like, even over the last year, we've had this European Copyright Directive, which would mean Google and Facebook would have to pay snippet taxes. Every country that's tried to implement that has come head-to-head with Google, who've just said, well, we'll just leave our search results blank for you then. We're not playing this game. I mean, I've got to write a chapter in our Media Moments report about this in a month.
That one chapter is going to equal the length of the rest of the report put together.
Well, why don't you just get this transcribed?
I'm probably over the word count already.
Then we're all royally f***ed.
Hey, speaking of royally f***ed, Peter, the next story is about print magazines and what has happened to print over the course of COVID. And this first bullet point you've got is horrifyingly stark.
What's happened to print, I think, is a mixed story, but the COVID crisis has accelerated all sorts of stuff in the media markets. And part of that is accelerating the decline or the demise of certain print titles.
But it's not even those kind of generalist print titles that we've seen dying out over the last couple of years.
Absolutely. So this week, DC Thompson announced 5 closures. And the mix there is mental. It's like Scottish Wedding, Number One, which was a lifestyle title, Sweet, which was a girl's, I think it's a teenage title, but it's certainly a girl's magazine. Slime Factory. I have no idea what Slime Factory is.
I was going to say, yeah, I wish I'd heard about that before.
I'm imagining it's a kids magazine to do with slime. And then a magazine called This Is, which was recently launched, and it's a different topic every issue. So there's, if you look at it, there's nothing really tying them together other than they were all kind of mad. Well, the quote from DC Thompson is, some magazines were marginal 6 months ago, are becoming, you know, commercially unsustainable because of the crisis.
But this, yeah, this is kind of what other people have said, is that the crisis is essentially accelerating. It's brought forward things that, you know, would these magazines have closed in the next 2 to 3 years? It's basically just brought that really, really far forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's, you know, that can be seen as a positive in some ways when you look at some of the things that have gone on with e-commerce, which we're going to talk about in a bit. Mm-hmm. I saw something, I think it was, his name, Ben Evans, talking about 5 years worth of e-commerce growth in 5 months.
3 months.
So there's stuff like that going on. But if you're reliant on the newsstand or reliant on advertising, then you got pounded in the lockdown. You know,
yeah.
I think this, when you look at the DC Thompson closures, the one that I think is saddest is the Scottish wedding closure. But you can totally understand why that happened. There were no weddings. The people that were advertising were venues. People weren't getting married, so they weren't buying magazines. That was a perfect storm for that magazine.
It really is.
And it's sad because it was quite an innovative title in that space.
It won't be the case. Like weddings will take place again next year, and the market will pick up next year. It's a shame it couldn't kind of go on hiatus rather than be closed completely.
But I think that's the, you know, there was a piece in an Australian niche publishing network which talked about publishing being in transition rather than dying. And one of the points that was made in that is that big publishers will close titles that don't suit their business strategy. Doesn't mean there's not an opportunity there, but the opportunity is probably going to fall to someone who's smaller and more cost efficient. You know, if whether it's DC Talk, so the list there is, Press Gazette has done a good job of kind of chronicling the closures that are going on. And it's them that's got this list of 40 titles, and they come from Bauer, they come from Immediate, they come from Future, from Kelsey. And again, there's nothing that really links them together other than these are publishers that have thought, right, we need to protect the broader business and get rid of these titles which we don't think are going to be sustainable.
Yeah, it's triage. And, you know, the only reason, like, I agree with you, this is more about an industry in transition than it is about an industry in terminal decline. But though a lot of those publishers were relying on the long tail of those magazines to fund experimentation and to fund kind of investment in what they might consider their core product. And without that long tail, which has just been completely excised by COVID, I struggle to see an upside here.
Also, I really feel for the people that lost their jobs. Like,
yeah,
what do you do? Like,
yeah, that's awful.
What have been some of the positive, you know, what have been some of the positives for the magazine industry from COVID? Because there have been a few.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Essa's talked quite a bit about this. Subscriptions are up. Some of them digital, but also print. Gardening, cooking, and magazines did well over the lockdown because everyone was gardening or cooking, or at least reading about it. Olive magazine was up 35%. And also...
Yeah, that one's good.
Kids newsweeklies, which, you know, totally makes sense, but I would never have thought about. The Week Junior was up 22% year on year.
Because it's absolutely desperate to entertain their children.
Exactly. Right, there's a bunch of parents just tearing their hair out, going, here, read this and shut up for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Or an hour. Actually, more likely an hour, because it will keep them occupied longer than the iPad will.
There were some crazy numbers there. Like one of the ones from Condé Nast. BuzzFeed reported Condé Nast has seen, I think it was 422% increase across its whole portfolio with subscriptions. I mean, that's crazy.
But, you know, it's because if people had time. Part of the reason that magazines haven't done so well in the past 4, 5, 6, whatever many years, is because people are suffering from time pressure. They don't have the time to sit down with a magazine. But if you're in lockdown, you've got plenty of time to sit down with a magazine.
Provided that the entire population of Britain gets thrown in prison magazine industry is saying.
Actually, that's a point. We need that. What do they call it in the States? Industrial incarceration complex?
Prison industrial complex. Yeah.
Well, I've seen some people talking about it's more about the reclaimed time. So if you're not going to spend 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the evening commuting, you suddenly finish at work at 5 o'clock and you've got time to do something between that and dinner. And you're not kind of constantly fighting to get to the next point of your day. It's just you can kind of reclaim all that time that you were once commuting and hold up on the tube.
So that's definitely true. But it's properly swings and roundabouts, isn't it? Because it's not, that reclaim time doesn't necessarily go into a format like magazines. And it's on the other end of the seesaw.
I've been in bed in the morning.
Yeah, that is great. That has been amazing. But the other end of the seesaw is, initially, I'm not quite sure if the numbers have returned, but podcast listeners were down because people listen to those on commute.
Yeah, there's half return people. In.
Yeah, there's been a recovery on that. If we've got to rely on people not going to work for the magazine industry to survive, then we're screwed. But hopefully there's
not
some kind of balance.
Peter. People are still working.
Well, you know what I mean.
I think
not everyone was. That's a point. There were so many people furloughed.
Yeah.
Will these, like, if you created a habit during lockdown, whether that's, I don't know, baking sourdough loaves or whatever, or reading magazines, is that something that's going to stick? Because we've been in this crazy situation long enough for things like this to stick. It's not been 2 weeks. It's been, oh my word, how many weeks has this been now?
Yeah. I don't think now is the time that that will show, because people probably took a 12-month subscription.
Mm.
When it will show is March, April, May next year.
Can I do a shameless plug at this point? We have actually written quite an extensive piece about this. So if you go to voices.media/analysis, you can see, will the COVID subscription bump last past next year?
As a corollary to that, though, did you see the Ofcom report into TV habits?
No. Nope.
Initially, they spiked, obviously, as you'd expect, in terms of OTT and linear TV in the early days of lockdown. And viewing habits, even though lockdown has only been eased, it hasn't been completely eliminated. Those habits have fallen back to pre-COVID levels. So I'm not convinced that a lot of the habits that people have picked up are habits. They're more like, okay, to go back to prison, it's more like having a prison wife. You know, you don't want to marry a fellow inmate, but you do because they're there.
Well, that's escalated really.
Can't top that.
The titles that come out the other side of this, I think, could survive, probably smaller, but definitely stronger.
So moving on to my first pick, and I looked at the ones that you both reserved, and I just thought we needed something a little bit less heavy. And so,
depressing.
Yeah.
So, welcome back to the Media Voices podcast, the most depressing podcast in your feed.
Over the course of summer, Vulture doubled its podcast coverage. And I'm not talking about podcast investment here. I'm talking about the amount of criticism, of podcast criticism that they actually publish on the site. So they already had a podcast-focused newsletter. They've since launched another one hosted by a chief podcast critic, Nick Kwa.
Yep.
But way back in the last Media Moments report, we actually said that we were bullish on the headroom for publisher investment in podcasting. And this, we spoke about the potential not just for publishers to make money from it their own, but as a sort of area of coverage. I suppose my question to you is, how wide do you think Vulture can go with this, and is there room for other publishers to follow suit? Is podcasting now big enough to be an area of criticism like film criticism or like video game criticism?
Yes.
What you're saying is, could Empire launch like a podcast magazine?
Yeah, exactly. Which would help with, because what's the biggest problem with podcasting at the moment? It's discovery.
Discovery.
Yeah, you cannot find new podcasts in as easily as you might like.
I think one of the other things that's going to be really interesting about this is it's going to be the expansion of the entertainment sector around it. So if you think about some of the biggest things that people have talked about over the last couple of years, it's been, you know, it's been Game of Thrones, it's been the Marvel films, it's been a lot of the really big, epic kind of narrative films. And if we can get that kind of thing with podcasts, and I've noticed Spotify have invested quite heavily in a couple of Warner Brothers storytelling type things. If you think about the biggest podcast at the moment, it's Serial, and that's the one that everybody kind of talks about and goes to. But if we can get a couple of really big hitters like that, that people are talking about it in work and saying, oh, you know, did you listen to the most recent episode of this? I don't know which drives it. I don't know if you'd have to have the criticism first and the recommendations first to drive that, or whether actually Spotify investing in it will again, help drive a little bit of that. But if we can get the, like, normal people talking about it and create those cultural moments, that could really accelerate listening elsewhere.
All right. Normal people as opposed to not people like us.
Basically, yeah.
Something I think is interesting there is you were, obviously it's distributed through Spotify, which technically makes them not podcasts. But what you were almost talking about there is serialized audiobooks or serialized radio programs.
Yeah.
So are we now seeing, is audio now collided with itself and just become a format that you can listen to whatever, regardless of genre, regardless of format? And is there enough crossover between, say, people listening to music on Spotify who will then just instinctively pick up kind of these new serialized fiction or true crime series?
I think you've kind of got a part of the problem there, is that podcasting is at a stage now where it doesn't know what it is anymore.
Mm.
You know, this whole conversation between what's a podcast and what's a show, and audio drama versus this kind of thing.
Yeah.
People listen to podcasts for different reasons, and I think as the audience grows, people that listen to our type of podcast will just become a subset of the type of people that listen to, I don't know, true crime podcasts or whatever, but also listen to audio drama and also listen to I'm trying to think of how you can make something like Game of Thrones work as an audio, but you know what I mean.
Well, look at the Archers,
blown past buster type.
I was thinking more. If you look at what Amazon's doing with Audible, it's essentially audiobooks.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, but audiobooks aren't podcasts, and that's what I mean. Podcasting doesn't know what it is anymore.
But yeah.
What's the difference between like a serialized podcast drama and an audiobook? The lines are so blurred now.
You've fallen into my trap that I set when I put this in there.
I don't agree. I think they have different audiences. People commit to them for different reasons.
So are you saying that in the same way that video isn't video, so people go to YouTube, they go to Twitch for very different reasons than they go to linear TV to keep up with their stories, there will always be that divide between audio content of different formats.
Yeah, because someone coming to this program, this podcast, hasn't got a clue what we're going to talk. We don't know what we're going to talk about. Whereas if you're tuning into the 43rd episode of a serialized audiobook, you've got a pretty good idea what's coming.
Unless it's like Welcome to Night Vale.
I see, that is a podcast though.
In the TV equivalent, like what are we like a... Are we Twitch rather than like a Netflix series?
Well, we're not.
We're not Netflix. That's interesting. Series. Although if Netflix wants to make a Media Voices series, just give us a call.
I think it's more like one of those smaller, more dedicated streaming services like Shudder for horror. We're the Shudder. We're the Shudder of the podcasting world.
That's twice. Goosebumps twice. Yeah. Goosebumps twice.
I was pumping for YouTube influencer, but no, apparently not.
Listen, we can also be YouTube influencers.
We can be heroes.
Video is merging as well. If you look at where YouTube are trying to invest and where Facebook are trying to invest and all that sort of stuff, like it's all becoming one wibbly wobbly timey wimey mess.
You absolutely nailed it when you said that discovery is a huge problem. I'm not sure that, you know, Nick Carr is brilliant when he's writing about podcasting as an industry.
Mm.
How that's going to play with a more consuming audience.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's the right guy or not. I look forward to seeing what he's doing. Yeah, there's a magazine in the UK that covers podcasts. It's called Pod Bible. It's done 10 issues. So, yeah.
Space for that kind of criticism, at least.
Definitely.
Nice.
Nice.
Well, not nice. Esther, what is the next story on this long list of grievances that you have against against platforms?
It's not grievances, it's just it all got so busy over the summer. Mm-hmm. So, Apple basically spent the entirety of the summer fighting with...
Yeah, proper feud.
Everybody, like, it got in fights with WordPress, it got in fights with Basecamp's Hey platform, so his biggest fight that ended up with was with Epic Games, who, for those of you less cool than me, are creators of Fortnite, which is a popular game that, like, teenagers dance too?
No.
They don't dance, do they? They floss.
Yeah, okay, right. Okay,
they kill people in it. They're not literally people.
Okay,
it's like a Hunger Games of games, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So back in 1996, Koshin Takami completed his novel Battle Royale. It was adapted to a manga in 1999 and a film in 2000 called Battle Royale. 100 students thrown into an island. They have to battle to the death. Only the last couple survive. Created the genre Battle Royale. Fortnite is an example of that, but done through games. It was itself a ripoff of DayZ, which was the first and biggest Battle Royale game. Epic used the success of Fortnite, particularly this Battle Royale mode, to set up the Epic Game Store, which is a counterpart to the Apple Store, which sets the scene for the rest of this tale. Esther, please continue.
I thought kids just floss on it, but okay. So anyway, Apple pulled Fortnite from the App Store after Epic accidentally on purpose snuck in a new payment option, which essentially bypassed Apple's 30% commission fee. That's against Apple's terms, so Apple said, yeah, sorry, you can't be in the App Store. And Epic basically rolled up its sleeves and released like this protest video.
Yeah.
As well as firing off within a day an antitrust lawsuit against both Apple and Google.
Oh, they were just sitting on that ready
they had that,
to go.
Yeah. You cannot create that video, which is the parody of the famous Apple ad.
Yeah.
You cannot just turn around and blast out in a day. That needed, not only because it had to go through like 8 levels of approval, presumably, but also because creating the assets for it took some time.
Yeah, so this was very much a, they knew what they were doing when they put this in, and they knew they'd get banned by Apple, and as soon as they did, they fired all this stuff off. Google's also involved in this, but you can apparently download Fortnite for Android directly from Epic's website, so it's slightly less severe. By the way, you can also now get iPhones on eBay with Fortnite installed for thousands of dollars. So Apple came back to this, and they basically said, well, Epic built most of its business on the App Store and doesn't deserve any special treatment.
Although it's since come out that they basically asked for special terms for Fortnite.
Yeah.
Right.
And a US judge ruled this week that Apple can continue to block Fortnite, but it cannot terminate Epic Games' wider developer accounts or its graphics tool and Unreal Engine until a full hearing is taking place at the end of September.
The story does not end here. No. Unreal Engine is one of the most commonly used game development engines as well, so this has the potential to really impact a ton of other people.
Yeah, but I think it would be a bit unfair of them to pull that for what basically is Epic Games' bigger problem with Fortnite. It'd be a bit of a dick move. Anyway, Facebook then piled on. Because they want to launch a paid online events system so that businesses can basically use Facebook as ticketing. But that would then get hit by Apple's 30% commission fee. So Facebook saw this opportunity, and they've never picked on Apple before, but they were like, okay, we're going to take this opportunity to also join the fight. So Facebook said that they wanted Apple to waive this 30% fee so that event hosts can keep all the money that they generate from ticketing. Apple politely declined, so that one is still pending. Then, a bunch of news publishers piled on 2 weeks ago. So Digital Content Next and Jason Kint wrote a letter to Tim Cook because it transpires that Apple have got a special deal with Amazon. And Amazon only have to pay, I think it's 15% for transactions that go through the App Store. So
my goodness.
Jason Kint was basically like, well, we represent a bunch of really high quality news publishers. What terms do we have to meet to get this special deal? Because that would then mean that publishers who sell subscriptions through apps on the App Store would only have to give over half of what they currently do to Apple. So it's all a massive pickle. And Apple basically at the stage where if they concede one lot, it's going to end up going like dominoes.
I mean, the word monopoly wasn't far from your lips there. Basically, this comes down to, is Apple too monolithic and will ultimately have to cave and allow this kind of alternate payment system across everything in the App Store?
Well, there's two different questions there. The answer to the first one is yes, and the answer to the second one is probably not, because the answer to the first one is yes.
Yeah. This did all come up. So if anybody that missed it, there was a massive antitrust hearing just after our last episode. that had Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Apple.
Tim Apple.
In really bizarre, like, in a really bizarre, like, basically web conference in front of Congress. And Apple were actually grilled about this.
That was great.
Specifically about the App Store monopoly. And he said that, well, it didn't constitute a monopoly because it was free for 84% of apps to be there, and that they haven't increased commissions on apps since 2008.
How the hell could you increase it to more than 30%?
You can increase it to 35%.
Later. Yeah, keep Jesus ticking, word. Keep turning that ticker. Like 30.1%. Oh, no, it's 30.5%.
I hate all these companies. I absolutely hate them. I mean, I use Apple products. I use Apple phones. I use an iPad, and I hate myself. I've got an Apple Watch. I'm about to throw my Apple Watch across the room.
You got an Apple Watch?
Yeah.
I never knew that.
I need it for my intense running regime.
We also need to be careful what we say about them, because they could kick us out the app, out the iTunes.
Oh, that's true. The point is, they make great stuff. But that, like Esther just said, it's just surrounded by all these dick moves.
So Amazon actually had this. They're looking to do their own podcast store, and they had in their terms and conditions that you couldn't say anything derogatory about Amazon.
My good f***ing God.
Oh, hang on a minute. I was slagging Amazon off earlier when I was streaming on Twitch.
It's fine. We're not in Amazon yet.
I wonder if my channel's going to be thrown off Twitch.
Anyway...
Help us, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're our only hope.
Yeah, this is all kind of pending at the moment. I think we're going to, a lot of people are waiting to see what happens with this lawsuit at the end of September.
God, but again, imagine if it's just been like, since the beginning of March, Tim Apple's been on a massive...
beginning of time.
Yeah, Tim Apple's been on a massive bender, and what, he's going to sober up soon and go, who's that start a fight with? Oh my God, everybody.
But, like, you know, Apple's big goal for the next couple of years is to up its services revenue. So there is no way that they are willingly going to concede on this. And I would just say, so Joshua Benton, who's writing for Nieman Lab, who's far more informed on this than I am, has written about three scenarios. And he thinks the most likely one is that actually it's going to end up in court or in front of a regulator that is going to insist that Apple and Google have to allow alternate in-app payment systems.
Mm-hmm.
Because he points to examples like Microsoft was ordered to allow other default web browsers, like, 20 years ago. So yeah, he reckons it's going to end up that way. And I'm inclined at the moment to agree. I just think it's going to take quite a while.
Oh, well, it's going to get fought. Yeah.
The Justice Department said that it's looking at antitrust action against Google this month. So there are models for regulating these kind of platform activities. It just needs someone with the cojones to actually do something about it.
It needs somebody who understands it, because this is the problem with a lot of our regulation. It's stuck 30 years ago, and it doesn't account for the way the digital world works.
Mm.
I mean, this all ends up tying back to the Facebook-Google thing. Like, it is, a lot of it is too late.
One of the things that's wrong with that sentence you just said, though, is the digital world works.
Yeah,
it doesn't. That's, you know, we're talking about Facebook and Google being regulated for taking people's ad revenue. Jesus Christ, how about regulating them for killing democracy?
Oh, okay. All right. I can feel the phrase "turn it off and on again" creeping over the horizon.
No, for this season
of Media Voices, I'm putting a moratorium on that phrase. We cannot resort to turning off the internet.
Okay, no, but I think, again, this comes down to an even bigger problem than that, and I'm not going to say turn it off and on again. That we are in a global world where these global companies operate, and we're trying to legislate them with individual legislation from, by comparison, tiny little countries. And it's, yep, unless we have some kind of worldwide agreement on this and worldwide law on this, which we're not going to get, we're not going to solve this problem.
You're saying we need some sort of
world government?
United, like, digital nations.
Jesus, yeah. QAnon is now listening in to the Media Voices podcast.
That doesn't even get started on the other shenanigans Apple's been up to with redirecting people who are searching for publishing news articles to News Plus by default. It's got plans to bundle News Plus into a load of, like, yeah, that's coming in October. Or there's, like, this whole app tracking in opt-in thing, which has blown up this week, about basically it's going to ruin every ad business on the planet.
Hooray!
Oh, Apple. I'm exhausted. I'm absolutely exhausted.
Well, Peter, that's a shame because you're about to talk about Vogue Business and the unstoppable rise of reader revenue.
But this isn't really about Vogue Business. What's happened over the summer was that Vogue Business launched a new membership scheme, which everyone's pretty surprised by because Vogue Business is only 18 months old. And although already it's got 340,000 members signed up for free, this paid membership model was a bit of a surprise. They built the new membership thing was announced as being built around deep dive insights and two exclusive newsletters. What I thought was interesting about this was immediately Sean Griffey, who started Industry Dive, which is a very successful B2B newsletter publisher. And he said at the time, Jesus, well, he didn't say Jesus, I did that. I'm paraphrasing because he's probably not blaspheming the way I am. He said, they've only been going for 18 months, but they're comfortable enough to launch a membership model. I'm really curious about how they're going to price this, which is really a polite way of saying, I don't think this is going to work. And our old boss, Neil Thackeray, was much more blunt than Sean and said, it will fail. Now, whether that's right or not, I don't know if it's right. Vogue Business seems to have its stuff to shit together. And, you know, I think if anyone can do it, they will. But to me, it throws light on this rush to secure reader revenues. And that eventually that is not going to work for people. The pricing model.
Saying, you're saying it's almost too crowded. This is a play to get potential reader revenue before it's completely saturated.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I don't know about The Athletic because they've been impacted by the COVID situation, but I think The Athletic is another example of someone who's maybe just going to struggle to get the business based on just membership model. And I know The Athletic does other stuff, but primarily membership revenues.
If you look at that, like, if they've got 340,000 members already, I get you, that's on a free tier, but if you're looking at even converting 5% of that, that's a pretty good base to be starting with.
Not if you look at the cost base. They've got 100 people working on this thing.
Presumably their main competitors for this are Business of Fashion.
I don't know that market particularly well, but yeah, Womenswear Daily, Business of Fashion, there's a couple other ones.
At which point, you've only got to undercut them by a little bit.
Yeah, okay, again, the pricing on this is $154 at launch for a year, but that's discounted from $220. But you don't get all the index and highlights and the insights and stuff to get the advanced membership that gives you all that. They're talking about $1,200.
Okay, but...
And if you want access to the actual business information stuff, it's basically call us up and we'll quote you. So it's like a proper Bloomberg business information service.
Yeah, that's the Bloomberg model, isn't it, for the pioneers?
We talked, I think just before we broke up for the holidays, about Skift, who've also launched pretty much exactly the same thing. They've got an access membership and then a separate membership for their reports and business insights. So why do people think that's going to work and this isn't?
I'm not saying this isn't going to work. I'm absolutely not saying that. I mean, if anyone can pull it off, Condé can pull it off. After, you know, Vogue's been in this market for centuries, whatever.
I think as well that the difference between Skift and Vogue Business is that the travel and tourism industry far outstrips the fashion industry in terms of how much is spent annually on it. So there is, I think it's what, tourism was worth $6 trillion last year and fashion was worth something like $1.5 trillion, which it's not peanuts. But at the same time, there is significantly more value in information about travel and tourism than there is about fashion.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that this is going to fail. You know, Neil Thackeray is, and Jesus, he's way smarter on this stuff than I am. But my point really is, reader revenue, you've got to think about it hard, and that's got to be part of the mix, not the whole thing.
Yeah. That pricing strategy confuses me quite a lot. That it seems to be positioned so that people almost don't want that lower tier. What for the people who would sign up to this, do they not want to sign up for that in-depth analysis which comes from the medium tier? Well, do you actually get from the lower one?
I mean, it's interesting because when they launched it, that insight aspect of this was played pretty heavily in the announcement. But then when you see the pricing structure, the insight aspect of it, which is bi-monthly deep dive reports, that is in this higher tier, which, you know, is 10 times more expensive, almost.
Okay, so why then were we up on the ticker from the information and down on this? Because the ticker was almost exactly this. It was that very digestible, bite-sized version of it in the same way that it sounds like the lower tiers for this.
Maybe just the price. I think maybe just the price point. The ticker, the price point on the ticker was, what, $20?
Yes, much, much lower.
So I don't know. It's definitely one to watch. I'd love to talk to Neil or Sean Griffey or anyone that's in this about this because, you know, they've got insights and it would make a really cool conversations episode if anyone wants to sponsor it.
So anybody from Condé who wants to sponsor that, get in contact.
I'm not at all having a go at Condé on this. I think, you know, to do this in the pandemic was bold as anything.
Yeah, definitely. There's certainly an early mover advantage to launching memberships.
Definitely.
And if we can take anything away from this, it's that I suspect everybody and their dog is going to launch a membership scheme. Maybe on OnlyFans, who knows? As a final story, again, I looked at the ones that you had and I thought, no, let's have a fun one. There has been an e-commerce surge. That won't surprise anybody. If you're anything like me, you've had an Amazon package out for delivery every single day of the pandemic, just for that endorphin rush. You know, I just need that dopamine hit from getting something through the post. And it's been predicated around home improvement, you know, health and fitness for the most part. But as Benedict Evans has noted, the sector, Peter, you mentioned this earlier, effectively underwent 5 years worth of growth in 3 months. It is, yeah. And if you look at the amount, so the UK, for instance, went from 20% e-commerce penetration to over 30% in 2 months, which is just an insane amount of onboarding. And I think speaks to the fact that
it's that low, actually.
Well, if you look at the stats, it's older people are the ones who had to pick this up. So they were the ones who were heading down to the grocery market or whatever and have now decided, no, actually I'll go with Ocado. But Esther, to go back to something you were saying before, the trend appears to be sticking even as those other kind of lockdown behaviors do revert to the mean. My question to the both of you is this now an opportunity for the publishers who are e-commerce heavy to grow their e-commerce businesses and maybe to even make some acquisitions in and around those areas?
I'm quite happy to take this one because I've literally just spoken to Future.
Do it.
Yeah, so I think Future, I think they're pretty much the e-commerce leading publisher in this country, aren't they?
Now they are, yeah, I think for sure.
Because they completed their TI Media acquisition in April and they're basically just building out their capabilities. But I was talking to their Homes MD last week about, because they chose to launch a gardening website in June as we were all stuck at home trying gardening. To do with our gardens. and they said actually one of the big shifts that they'd seen is that normally, you know, if you want to go and buy a sofa or you want to go and buy a barbecue and you want to go and buy a big ticket item, you might be fine ordering, you know, shoes and whatever on Amazon, but generally for those things, you want to go and see it and sit on it and test it and, you know, with the barbecue, try and see how easy it is to fire up and stuff. But actually, you've not been able to do that unless you're prepared to queue for 3 hours to get into B&Q. So he says that they've seen quite a big shift in the willingness of people to buy quite big ticket items online.
Just based on the strength of reviews and okay.
Makes sense. No, it's to do with the fact that they can't do it anywhere else, so they're then turning to publishers. So, you know, if I wanted to buy a hot tub, I might turn to Future for their...
This is like the most f***ing middle-class episode of Media Voices ever.
Yes.
Barbecues, hot tubs, gardening, sofas. Jesus Christ.
So he says that it's quite interesting, this shift in willingness of people to buy those bigger ticket items, and he thinks that that's going to be something that sticks. So people are going to sort of say, well, normally I'd go and check out a sofa, but actually... I bought it online, you know, in lockdown, it was fine, so I'm going to buy another one online now. And then it's going to be the bigger habits like that that mean that for e-commerce publishers, there's a lot more opportunities in that space for bigger items, which in turn makes them more money.
But here, okay, so All right, here's my counterpoint
to that.
There's
always a but.
So right at the start of lockdown, more people started ordering beer online. And they were doing it through their sort of local bottle shops. Then the breweries realized that they could be selling to customers direct. And so they've undercut a lot of the local bottle shops by selling D2C based, you know, purely from their websites. So is the real winner for this not going to be places like, I don't know, DFS, who start doing some real content marketing? Does DFS still exist?
Yes. Thanks.
Okay.
No, but that's where, again, I don't know about beer. I don't know how people buy beer. But for a lot of things, people want reviews. And I mean, we've had this argument before. We've been picked up on it before. But people want to know, you know, what are the specs of this? How does it test out? What does a neutral person think of this? You know, it's why places like Witch have seen record traffic. And again, Future's seen record traffic to a lot of its review sites. You don't just want to go on Amazon and buy a barbecue. You want to read about what the pros and cons of all these barbecues are before you make a decision to buy one.
So the thing I think is particularly interesting about this is, do those sites, do, you know, Future, do they have a dedicated, trusted, say, barbecue reviewer? who people can go? Because there's one thing to have trust in a brand to review something, but the individual surely is the ultimate arbiter of that. So in the same way that I go to a couple of influencers to see which games I should be playing...
Yeah.
Are there barbecue influencers?
Well, yeah. It's not about barbecue influencers, is it? You probably don't know who wrote the review. It's the title. You're looking at the chops of Barbecue Monthly. No, so you look at Runner's World if you want to buy shoes, or you look at Cycling if you want to buy a bike, or you look at Hi-Fi, if it's such a thing anymore, to buy a music system. It's the title that brings the trust around that recommendation, not the actual reviewer.
So you're saying that there's no such thing as a primacy of reviews journalist in the same way that there is, say, a columnist?
I think there is. I think this raised by publisher, because, again, Hearst, they launched... So they've had the Good Housekeeping Institute for about a decade, where they've reviewed things like vacuum cleaners and washing machines specifically for good housekeeping. And they've just gone and built, like, a socking great... the Hearst Institute out in London, where they're going to test stuff for all the Hearst titles. And it means that if you're looking at 10 best washing machines, those washing machines have actually been put through their paces by an actual person with actual standards.
Yeah, but no one ever knows who that person is. It's the brand that gets that brings the cachet.
Yeah, and in that case, it's having the Hearst Institute approved that means that you have trust that washing machine does what it says.
So in the same way that Witch has built its reputation on being an impartial observer, the Hearst Institute is going to do exactly the same thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
So Hearst, if you need a hot tub reviewer, I can be found at chris@voices.media.
I could actually do with a new barbecue. You know, the big message that's coming out of this week's episode is, don't trust the platforms, kids.
So you do what BuzzFeed and you do what GQ are doing, which is you do it yourself.
Yeah, that's that's becoming a bigger thing. GQ Shop just launched, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but also there was a story over August about a load of publishers banding together. So because Amazon cut these rates, a load of publishers are banding together to launch their own Prime Day.
Oh, I saw that, yeah.
Which, yeah, that sort of thing is really cool. And actually, if Amazon are going to do that, there's plenty of other places that... so I think, again, Future's e-commerce boxes work off scouring the internet for the best deal and not necessarily going through Amazon. So if Amazon aren't paying the best affiliate commission rate, they'll go somewhere else.
So
there are ways around it. Just Amazon is the easiest one.
Yeah, when I put this in there, I was like, okay, great. We'll be able to have a happy ending to the episode. We'll be able to say, yeah, absolutely, there's an opportunity here. And instead, we've come back to platform hell.
Bastards.
So thank you very much for listening to this upbeat and sunny return of Media Voices. We're going to be back for the next couple of weeks. Well, I suppose for the foreseeable future until the winter break, bringing you another episode of the Media Voices podcast. If you are desperate for more content, you can go to voices.media and sign up for our daily newsletter. If you have tried to sign up before but not got anything, please do try again, because one of the boxes was broken. Oops. And check your spam as well, because the confirmation might have gone there. Or you can go to our Twitter, which is @MediaVoicesPod, and check out a sample every morning. It goes out at 7 a.m.
I feel a bit under pressure now, because Thomas Pixel has pointed out the right way to pronounce this, and it's actually quite hard. So Ko-Fi. Or Ko-Fi, or coffee, or have.
Oh my God!
That's because he's Danish, right? And he's right. spot, that's like someone saying Paris.
Okay. Anyway, if you've enjoyed,
we should have just gone on OnlyFans.
If you've enjoyed this episode and you would like to fuel us further, you can buy us a virtual coffee on Ko-fi. Or you can just go to voices.media and there's a lovely button called support there where you can essentially just buy us a coffee from there. So yeah, please do that.
We're even grateful if you come to our website, which is at voices.media. If you go there, you can find the latest episode of the podcast. You can find the stuff that we've been writing. You can find an amazing little podcast series that's developing at the moment around our Publisher Podcast Awards called Lessons from Award-Winning Publisher Podcasts.
So do check out our podcast mini-series. But until next week, when we'll be back with a fantastic guest. So thank you very much for listening and stay safe.
Bye.
Wear a mask.